90.5 WKAR. Welcome to Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. We are glad that you have fled the polar vortex and can join us. You didn't think we'd be talking about polar vortices in July, 6 months or so after our intimate experience with the polar vortex back in January. It's scarcely believable, but it is indeed the case. Coming up this hour here on Current State, we take a visit to the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, which kicks off tomorrow evening in Jackson. We talk with Jan Blixt, who is the festival's artistic director, and we talk about their choice of Hamlet as a presentation. And we talk with a couple of the four Democratic candidates for our 8th District Congress congressional contest. Susan Grettenberger and Jeff Hank are along in just a little bit to explain their approach to campaigning and meeting the candidates. They're going to do so as a group. All four are going to be making appearances together and engaging with everybody en masse. So we'll find out more about that decision and how it's going coming up in just a little bit. To start our program, many in our state are closely watching events in Vassar, Michigan. The community, 65 miles northeast of Lansing in Genesee County, could become the temporary home of 60 to 120 mostly young refugees from Central America. A human services agency, Wolverine Human Services, is offering to temporarily house and care for the arrivals. On Monday, that proposal spurred about 50 protesters, some waving flags and carrying guns, who called for an end to what they described as an invasion. The asylum seekers are part of a dramatic increase in young people seeking refuge in the United States. Many are fleeing drug-related gang violence in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. More than 50,000 unaccompanied minors have appeared at the U.S. border so far this year. Our next guest represents Vassar in Congress. Democratic Representative Dan Kildee hopes the U.S. Health and Human Services Agency accepts Wolverine's offer to explain why and to discuss other aspects of this complicated and emotional issue. Current State welcomes back Congressman Dan Kildee. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
How much do you know, Congressman, about Wolverine's proposal that is currently before the HHS? Do you know how it would likely play out if it went forward?
Well, Wolverine has applied to be a subcontractor with an organization based in Chicago called Heartland, which has been providing services to the Department of Health and Human Services for some time. So the decision is yet to be made, first of all, to place these unaccompanied children seeking refuge, to place them in facilities such as the one that Wolverine provides, and even further, the decision hasn't been made to use Wolverine if in fact it is the case that those placements are made. But I do think it's fair for the community to understand that this is a possibility, and we just wanted to make sure that people had the opportunity to voice their opinions.
Would it all be kids, Congressman?
Pardon me?
Would it all be children?
Yes, yeah, that's Wolverine's mission, and their licensing is just for children.
Okay.
So it would not be adults, it would be the children, unaccompanied children that have asylum claims because of the conditions in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, and they would be presumably placed there for a relatively short period of time until their case can be determined or a more permanent housing situation could be located.
Have you thought any more, though, if assuming it did go forward, have you given much thought to what this proposal would set in motion? It would seem to set other forces in motion: food, medical care, temporary education, perhaps.
Right. And so I talked yesterday with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and she was, Secretary Burwell, was quite assuring that if, in fact, this placement were to occur, that all of the costs associated with the care, support, education, health care, mental health would be provided as a part of the services that the federal government would fund. This would clearly be a federal responsibility. The location, if it is selected, would be under a contract through this organization in Chicago, and all the costs would be borne. I know there have been some concerns expressed that local communities would have to take on the cost of these additional individuals in the community. And that is not the plan, has never been the plan, and it's something that I think ought to be made very clear.
Is federal money set aside for a purpose like this now?
Well, that's one of the issues, is that the funds that are typically used for this purpose will likely run out sometime in August. So the president has requested the supplemental appropriation that would deal with issues on the border, increased border security, increased judicial capacity to more quickly adjudicate the cases that are coming before the Customs Bureau, because we have, right now we have 240 judges with a caseload of about 1,400 each. It takes sometimes years for these cases to be heard. We need to expedite these cases. So we'll have hopefully some money to do that, to speed up the process, and then some money to support the placement of these children in a secure environment until their cases can be determined valid or invalid. And if not valid, then there would be funding to send them back to their home country.
We're talking
But the problem is that we don't, right now, the size of this problem is greater than the resources available, and that's why the president has asked for supplemental funding.
We're talking with U.S. Congressman Dan Kildee of Michigan's 5th District about the plan put forth to bring 60 to 120 young Central American refugees to the community of Vassar, which is in Congressman Kildee's district. Tell us more about why you support this approach.
Well, first of all, I don't have any position on whether Wolverine is the appropriate setting. My view is that if the Department of Health and Human Services determines that Wolverine is the appropriate setting, that we have to really ask ourselves some serious questions as a nation about what kind of a country we are. I think we ought to be welcoming in the sense that this is a humanitarian crisis. Children are at great risk. They are being sold into sex trafficking. They are often being threatened, sometimes killed, in the drug wars that are taking place in these countries. It's a true humanitarian crisis. And we have to be consistent with our values and realize that these are, while they're not American citizens, they're human beings. And we have within our power to protect these precious human lives from danger. I agree with Pope Francis. We ought to do what we can to make sure that they're protected, and then simultaneously deal with the issue of immigration reform and how we're going to process these cases.
So it's primarily a refugee issue and not an it's a refugee issue before it's an immigration issue.
Exactly.
Am I hearing you right? Okay.
Yes, and the problem, of course, is that the immigration issue itself is rife with problems. There are broad views across the political spectrum on the question of immigration. And it's really important that we keep in mind that we have to have this debate about immigration reform, but we also have to realize that there can be other occurrences, and this humanitarian crisis is a real crisis. I spoke to Bishop Sistone, who is the bishop of the Saginaw Diocese, Catholic bishop. He has visited El Salvador, told me about the conditions that he saw. I've talked to other members of Congress, Congressman David Price, who just visited Guatemala and Honduras over last weekend. These kids are in danger, and that's why they are fleeing their home countries. We need to keep in mind that that is a real crisis that we have an obligation, I think, as a member of the global community to address, and not conflate that issue with this broader issue of immigration reform. It's an important question. It's one that I wish that the Republican leadership in Congress would allow a full and complete debate on so that we could get on with dealing with the immigration crisis. Our broken immigration system needs to be addressed. This situation is a case in point. But we can't allow, I don't think, a true humanitarian crisis to be conflated with the immigration question and then miss the opportunity and, I think, the obligation to protect children who are in danger and somehow pat ourselves on the back, as some have done, for their righteousness and saying that we're going to seal the border and not let these kids in. If we do that, I feel that we have to examine our consciences as a nation and accept the fact that we might be responsible for great harm that could befall these children.
In your view, is getting back to the Wolverine proposal here, Does it include provisions for green cards or temporary citizenship, or is this strictly an effort to buy some time and process all of these cases in the courts? That seems to be what you're saying.
That's precisely what it would be.
Okay.
The opportunity for the asylum claim to be heard. It's a judicial proceeding. It's not something that can be just determined by a border security agent. There has to be some, investigation into the claim, because obviously what we don't want to do is to simply open the border to anybody who claims that they are in danger or seeking asylum for purposes that might not be borne out by the facts. We want to make sure that the kids who need protection, who are truly at risk, get that protection, which is consistent with a law signed by President George W. Bush, enacted almost unanimously by Congress. So it's not been the subject of political fighting. This is something that has been in law now for 6 years. But to also make sure that what we're not doing is allowing for a long-term stay for people who are, which it's theoretically possible some are taking advantage of the humanitarian crisis to try to use that pathway as a way to get into the United States. We have to make sure that we don't allow for that. And that's why we need more judicial capacity. We need more immigration court judges. And the president's supplemental appropriation would provide for more immigration court judges to much more quickly hear these cases, make a determination, send the ones that don't qualify back to their home country, and then provide a more permanent asylum for those that truly are at risk.
Let's go a little bit deeper into that measure you just alluded to, signed in 2008 by President Bush. This is the Wilberforce Human Trafficking Act. 2 weeks ago, in an effort to ease this situation, President Obama called for revisions to that act that would allow Border Patrol agents to make deportation decisions themselves and more quickly deport children back to their home country that clearly have no business coming here, that don't have a justifiable case. What do you make of that proposal?
Well, I'm open to looking at that proposal. I think we have to be careful to make sure that what we're doing is not, as I said, making decisions that end up endangering these children as they're returned. I think what the president has proposed, this has been in debate here in Congress for a few weeks now, is to treat asylum seekers from non-contiguous countries the same way we would treat somebody coming from Canada or Mexico, which would be to allow them to voluntarily return at the border, to basically allow them voluntarily to be turned around rather than be taken into custody. That doesn't mean that there still wouldn't be some asylum claims, but it would potentially reduce the number of cases that would have to be adjudicated. I'm open to that, but I want to make sure that there are adequate protections to make sure that we're not empowering customs officers, border security officers, to engage in what is essentially a judicial review. We've never in this country granted our police agencies judicial authority. So we want to be careful to make sure that we're doing this in a proper way. But yes, I am open to that possibility, and I think we should consider legislation that would improve that law. And I think the president may have a point there.
A letter from your Republican colleague Candace Miller of Michigan's 10th District recently went to Secretary Burwell of HHS, and among a number of concerns that she mentioned in that letter, she wanted to know if HHS knows whether Michigan may be considered for more asylum seekers. Do you know anything about that? You just spoke with Secretary Burwell yesterday, correct?
Right. No, I mean, I've only heard that from Congresswoman Miller, but it may be the case. She indicated to me that she had spoken to an individual within the Department of Health and Human Services that said that there are other facilities being considered. But it's important to keep in mind how this process works. These agencies apply to the federal government for these contracts. So it's not as if the federal government is out sort of looking around and saying, oh, we want you. This is a process that is part of the normal procurement process. It'll be an expedited procurement. But these agencies that have capacity, like Wolverine or like Heartland in Chicago, apply to the federal government, have to have their their proposals reviewed, and then there's a selection process based on appropriateness, based on cost, and other competitive factors. So that it may be the case that there are other agencies within Michigan that are considering making application. I have not heard of any, but of course, the only one that is really come to our attention is the one that's in Tuscola County in my congressional district.
I just want to share with our listeners that we did reach out to Congressperson Miller, too, by the way, about appearing on our program today. She was unable or declined. In general, we've got less than a minute, Congressman. Characterize, summarize how your constituents are weighing in on this topic.
Well, I mean, the passions obviously run very high, and the loudest voices have been those in opposition. We saw an unfortunate demonstration a couple of days ago where individuals were wearing AR-15s, machine guns, basically, weapons. And, I'm a little troubled by what message they're trying to send, but I think for the most part, the people that I have spoken to directly are compassionate people and believe that we ought to do what we can to protect these kids. And I think that's the vast majority of people within my district.
Congressman Dan Kildee here on Current State. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, the 20th Michigan Shakespeare Festival season, includes what might be the biggest of all the Bard's works, Hamlet. Current State Scott Pold is here with a preview of the season, which starts Thursday night in Jackson. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. Yes, Hamlet tops this year's Michigan Shakespeare Festival schedule. But as has become customary, a lesser-known Shakespeare play is on the schedule, too, along with one non-Shakespeare classic. I talked with the festival's artistic director, Jan Blixt, about choosing Hamlet for this season.
Well, this is our 20th anniversary, and we choose our seasons about 9 months in advance. And so it was January of 2013 that I had to pitch it to the board. And when I was looking at shows for this season, this is our 20th anniversary, and most theaters don't make it this long. And not only have we made it this long, but for the past few years, we've been growing. And so I said, I want to do Hamlet because I want to go big or go home. This is the longest of Shakespeare's plays. It's the best known of Shakespeare's plays. It's the one that when you say to people Shakespeare, they often say Hamlet. I think it's also one of the ones that a lot of people had to read in high school and might hate. So one of my goals in life is to resurrect Shakespeare from the horrible memories of people from having to slog through it from when they were in school as soon as it was okayed. And I started talking to the actor that I wanted to play Hamlet. I knew that this was going to be something special, something interesting, and I really feel bad for anyone who misses this one because it really will let people know why 400 years later Hamlet is considered the best play in English literature. It's the kind of show that we had to put a lot more pre-prep into, and we had to really make a lot of decisions early about what story we were going to tell. This is a play that could easily run 5 hours. And no, we are not going to ask any of our audiences to sit through 5 hours. It runs about three right now. And in order to do that, a lot of decisions had to be made before we even got into the rehearsal hall about what story we were telling and how we were going to tell it. So this production very much stands on its own. It is itself.
When you decide to stage, say, a three-hour version as opposed to the five-hour version, does the three-hour version already exist out there?
No,
or do you have to do your own editing?
Yes, we do our own adapting. The process for Hamlet started again with, I always start with the folio, which is the 1623 version of the plays. We believe that that is the closest to what Shakespeare actually wrote. His plays were not actually published in his own hand during his lifetime. And so the 1623 folio is considered the best version. I always start with that. And again, 5 hours. So I start looking at what part of the story I want to tell. In Hamlet, you've got this domestic drama of what's going on between he and his family. You've got kind of a spy story going on, what's happening between Denmark and Norway. You've got the personal, of course, fight that's going on with him and himself. Can he do this? You've actually got kind of an action story that's running through it with these swashbuckling sort of characters. And so it becomes what is the most important part. And I decided early on that the most interesting part to me was this man, this brilliant, educated, stylish, fascinating man who has been raised his entire life and groomed to be the king. This is something his entire life he's known he was being set up for, and they have given him all of the knowledge, all of the skills that they could possibly give him so he would be a great king. And all of his life he was expecting this to happen, and when his beloved father dies, it's pulled out from him. And he's basically put under house arrest in his childhood home by his uncle, who has taken the throne. I thought, personally, that that was the most interesting story. So a lot of the other things started to fall away, which is why in this production we don't have Fortinbras in Norway coming in. I love the parallel storyline. I love that this all happens. But again, that's 5 hours of show. So as soon as I decided to lose the external elements of it, the Norse version and the problems between Denmark and Norway, that knocked out an hour right there. And so from there on out, it became surgical trimming based on clarity, based on the emphasis that we wanted the different scenes to have. We started taking things from the different quartos and making changes based on other versions of the text because we wanted it to be as strong and as clear a production as possible. So the final version of the script that we have, which in truth was probably finalized maybe the end of last week, we've been making changes and alterations to it up until then, comes from the First Folio, the Arden. It comes from the Second Quarto, known as the Bad Quarto. Just all different sources to put together this story. And that's kind of the dramaturgical work that has to go into putting up a production of Hamlet.
In what ways have you updated the setting?
Well, the set itself, we went off of the Gothic look of old European castles. So it very much has the look of an 11th century, 12th century castle. But we are setting it modern dress. We are setting it very much modern European royalty. I find it fascinating that Queen Elizabeth lives in Windsor Castle on the weekends. Windsor Castle was built in 1070. So it has the trappings of the power of her position as queen. And that was one of the things we wanted to have, was this Hamlet and the family constantly overshadowed by the history of this family, the history of Denmark, the power of the royalty. And in this particular case, he is not wielding it. He is trapped by it.
Who's your star?
My star is, he'd actually giggle if he heard that, because he's a character actor and he's brilliant. And his name is Sean Fausch. And he is a musician and a singer and an actor and a playwright in his own right. He is a multi-talented and fascinating guy. And as soon as Hamlet was announced and as soon as the board accepted my proposal, I went to him first and said, hey, I really want you to play this. And I was fortunate enough to have someone who said yes and then spent a few months just reading it. And then we were able to get together after I had made some of the initial cuts and talked about initially what I wanted the show to be. He got very involved in the process. And it has been a terrific experience to be able to work with an actor who is completely accepting of the story that I want on that stage and that I want my audiences to see, but he's also bringing so much of himself to it and working with me to make the show stronger. He is absolutely amazing. I think people are going to fall in love with him.
We're talking with Jan Blix, who is the artistic director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. And Jan, here is your chance to tell all but maybe the very most ardent admirers of the Bard about Cymbeline. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are pronouncing it, yes.
Almost unknown to modern audiences.
It is a very, very rarely produced show, and I'm not necessarily sure why, because it's fascinating. Cymbeline is one of the later plays in Shakespeare's career. It's when he was starting to get more into the Jacobean drama. It's romantic with a capital R. It is a comedy in the traditional sense that means, you know, the villains go down and the heroes win in the end, which is great. But it is not necessarily one of his light comedies. It's not a romantic comedy. The story is the king of Britain in the first century AD is King Cymbeline. And this is a time when the armies of Augustus Caesar were trying to invade and were starting their invasion of Britain. And he, at the beginning of the play, is under the thrall of his wife, the queen, who is, it's sort of hinted at, has a little bit of witchcraft in her, a little bit of something going on. And she is a very prototypical wicked stepmother. Her stepdaughter, Cymbeline's daughter Imogen, the princess, has married her childhood sweetheart, and that is not the person that the queen wanted her to marry. And so her husband has been banished. The kingdom has basically been taken over by the evil queen. They're worried about the Roman invasion, and the rest of the play is bringing it all together. And because there are so many elements of Cymbeline that will be recognizable to a modern audience because it almost feels Grimm's fairy tale-like. You've got your wicked stepmother, you've got your plucky heroine, you've got your situation where the king has been sort of sidelined. You're going to recognize a lot of these elements. And because of that, Robert Kiszlerik, who is directing the show, decided to really go with a storytelling fairy tale quality to it. So it's very much being told like a fairy tale, and this is the story of Cymbeline.
Now, for your non-Shakespeare program, the importance of being earnest would seem to be a perfect fit for this festival. Tell me about choosing this play.
When I approach putting together a season, what I try to do is choose one play that everyone knows, automatically is Shakespeare. For instance, Hamlet. The second show is always a Shakespeare show, but is a lesser known, doesn't get produced as much. In this case, Cymbeline. Both of those shows have a lot of humor to them, but I don't think either one of them is what you would call a raucous comedy. And what we try to do with the third classical show that isn't Shakespeare is to make sure that the season is rounded out and that there's something for everyone. So being that the importance of being earnest is just a funny, fun, witty, clever, laugh-out-loud show, that is what I felt would be the best in order to balance the three different productions and give something to any audience that likes classical theater.
Michigan Shakespeare Festival performances through August 17th are at the Bauman Theater inside the Potter Center at Jackson College. The festival kicks off with a preview performance of Hamlet on Thursday night. The full schedule, including showings of Cymbeline and the importance of being earnest, can be found at MichiganShakespeareFestival.com. And it's important to check the schedule, I think, to make sure people know that it isn't Hamlet the first weekend, Cymbeline the second weekend, that sort of thing.
No,
the
we
shows
run and rep.
Mix up.
Yep.
Yeah. Artistic Director Jan Blixt of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Next time you're listening online, visit and like our Facebook page, please, at facebook.com/currentstate. You can follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState. Past segments at WKAR.org. It's not uncommon in local or regional political races for several candidates to run together as a slate to fill a number of vacancies. For example, candidates for the local school board sometimes appear together as a unit in hopes voters will sweep them all into office. That doesn't happen in larger elections, say for a seat in Congress. But The four Democrats running to replace Republican Mike Rogers in Michigan's 8th District are trying an interesting strategy. Eric Schertzing, Ken Dargis, Susan Grettenberger, and Jeff Hank have vowed to campaign together between now and the August 5th primary to make themselves as accessible as possible to voters. We're joined today by two of those candidates, Susan Grettenberger and Jeff Hank. Welcome back to Current State to both of you. For a little more context, let's listen to one of your fellow Democratic candidates, Ken Darga, talking about this approach.
That isn't something that we decided just over the past couple days. That's how we've been campaigning from the beginning. We haven't been tearing one another down. We haven't been afraid to agree with one another, and there's a lot that we agree with one another on. And we haven't been afraid to give one another credit for good ideas. I think that's the way campaigns should take place, and that's the way that this campaign is taking place on the Democratic side.
So, Susan, clarify for us, are you all still making solo appearances or not?
Oh, yeah, we are still making solo appearances. We are all campaigning for ourselves as well, but we feel real strongly that it's important for voters to have enough information about all of the candidates that they can make a choice and that that's not determined by somebody else making a decision about how much coverage to give us or money, really, to dictate that. And I think that expands not just for the primary, but into the general election. We feel like money has too big a part to play in this. We fundamentally disagree on the process and how people are given or granted access and are really trying to take this straight to the media to ask for opportunities to present our case together.
So you've carved out some number of dates between now and August 5th when you know all four of you are going to be in the same place at the same time. Do I understand that correct, Jeff?
Well, no, unfortunately not, Mark. I mean, what we really did yesterday, rather than saying we're campaigning together, is that we have a unified message that we want voters to get involved. We want to get all of our messages out to voters so they can make the most informed decision. For example, all four candidates are from Ingham County. We have yet to even have a single forum or debate in Ingham County with an election 3 weeks away. So our goal in this more is to change the culture of politics. And this is a role for the candidates, this is a role for the voters, this is a role for the media. Our democracy functions best when people participate and when people are informed. And unfortunately, we're not at the level that we need to be. So we're still competing for the seat against each other. We've agreed that we will appear if there's a forum or debate called, but someone needs to set that up. And I think everyone still wants to win the seat individually, but we agree that there's a problem essentially in the culture, and that's what we're trying to improve.
Well, that's your loftier goal, but are you saying you don't have particular times and dates and places when all four of you will be appearing together?
We are asking the media to give us those opportunities. Oh. That is part of what we were trying to accomplish yesterday and hoping we can get out there. We're going to actively pursue opportunities. We have people that will be working on reaching out to media and asking media to give us the opportunity to come in together and to meet together, to have an open forum on air with some of the media.
And would these be like the TV televised primary debates that we've all seen where you're all fielding questions one at a time, or are you holding conversations with voters simultaneously?
Well, we do have a forum scheduled next Tuesday, Mark, in Lansing from 7 to 9 p.m. at the IBEW Hall in South Pennsylvania. But this is what's kind of frustrating because at this point, we don't even have a format for this forum. We haven't even told what the structure is. We just found out who the moderator was the other day. So as of now, that's the only event where all four of us are going to be together. And this hasn't been advertised either. So part of our goal here is to get the advertisement out about this and let people know there will be a time where you can hopefully come and actually question all four of us and get straight answers from us. Because most voters, and we've all experienced this, don't know who any of the four candidates are. And so our goal is really to, you know, say, here's our message. You know, you decide. Do your research, do your fact-checking, and question us and get straight answers from us.
You've just done – go ahead, Susan.
Well, I was going to say part of this is a challenge to the media. We can hold a forum or someone can set up a forum in a specific location in an auditorium and invite people to come. There are so many seats. We can invite so many people. Who knows who's available on a given Tuesday night? We know that there are a lot more people listening today, for example, than there would be if we invited the listeners of Current State to come listen to us at an auditorium at Lansing Community College, for example. If we can get the media to invite us, we're open to the format. We're not asking or seeking to dictate a format. We'll let the hosts of the media show let us know what they want. Could be caller call or phone in. It could be a talk show. It doesn't have to be someone who's necessarily sympathetic to our cause or to our party. I think our intention is to try to find whatever means we can to let the voters know who we are and to make sure that money does not determine that. One of the concerns I have is that somewhere along the line, the for-profit media decided a horse race where there are winners and losers, and we can say who's leading and who's, you know, who's behind, who just had a really good shot, so to speak, is better press than being a public service to the voters and making sure people really get to know the candidates. And we think the latter is important.
What's been the heavy? Have you had any response to what you've put out there already? This is amounts to something of a challenge to
sure.
the media. Have you had a response, Jeff?
Well, we were on TV last night.
All four of you.
Actually, the media, and this was Channel 10, and this isn't taking a shot at Channel 10 or anything, but they quoted one candidate. Everybody participated yesterday, but Sue and I were the ones who took the lead in the initiative on this. I think everyone shares the same goal, but I mean, this is part of the issue here is that, you know, we had a long press conference, we all spoke, and only one person's message or one person's quote actually gets out to the media. So it's a challenge, and it's frustrating as a candidate. Again, it is a money issue, but it's also a party machinery issue, and it's also just a larger problem in our culture that, you know, like a station like WKAR is great because you're due the public service, and you have one of the best programs in the area, but we need everyone to get involved in that and to do it more because, again, people don't know us. And if we want to win this seat, regardless of which party wins or what people believes, we need American people to get involved, get informed, get active. That's how we make this country strong and great, and we're missing the mark on that.
We're talking with Democratic congressional candidates Jeff Hank and Susan Grettenberger campaigning for the Democratic nomination for Mike Rogers' seat here in the 8th District. Did it take long for the four of you to agree to make this appeal, Susan?
No, I think, as Ken said, we have been pretty collegial all along. My goal in getting into this race in the first place was that I disagreed with the policies that were in place. As a professor, I was seeing things that were going on for students. As a social worker, I've seen a number of people working poor, middle class hurt. We felt like we needed to really take on this seat. I think we all have better policies and better, I think, better approaches that will be more fair to the people in this district. So I think we agreed, you know, our primary interest is to get the seat into the hands of somebody that's more progressive than the person we've had representing us. But so I think we're pretty much on the same page that we want to get the word out to the voters.
You've said you don't want the influence of money to dominate the election. And I think you've all alleged at one time or another that's exactly how it's unfolding on the GOP side.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mike Bishop came out with numbers the other day that he raised twice as much as Tom McMillan. We'll unfortunately probably be outgunned as Democratic candidates. And, you know, everyone, Mark, I hear this all the time. Everybody complains about money in politics. Well, we don't have a solution really to take care of that. But the one thing that can trump money in politics is people becoming aware and getting involved in the process. If people vote, they can actually change things. So this is a cultural change here. And Susan and I have discussed how, regardless if either one of us wins this election, and it's an open election right now, no one knows who's going to win or who's even in first place. There's been no polling done. We want to change the culture for the long term. This is about a generational idea. This is about changing the culture, improving the culture, so that if it didn't happen this election, and we've all learned that the system is imperfect as it is now, our goal would be 2 years from now, hopefully we can encourage people to get involved and improve it for the next time.
Once there's a candidate among the four of you, though, isn't that candidate automatically going to be very interested in raising as much money as possible?
Well, I think that's part of the problem. I've played sports all my life. I still play soccer. And I think the rules of the game dictate how the game gets played. The rules of the game right now are you have to have a lot of money. If a person has a limited amount of money or can't self-fund or does not have insider connections to raise money, it becomes almost impossible. So somebody like Jeff, who's been an advocate, or me as an educator, as a social worker, a person who has extensive experience and a deep commitment to doing this, comes into the process, it becomes very, very difficult for us to have a fair playing field. And it's not so much about the individual people and whether or not Jeff or I is elected. It's that the voters need to have the opportunity to know the candidates well enough so they can decide. Somebody yesterday said, well, why don't the four of you just decide one person to put forward if you want the seat? It's like, we're only four votes. Why should we decide? The people with the money, each only have one vote. Why should they have that much influence? We need to find mechanisms for getting information to voters so they can be informed.
You're suggesting a pretty serious lack of engagement on the part of voters.
Mm-hmm.
Encountering that so far since you declared as candidates. You've witnessed that, or are there pockets of urgency out there, or what?
There are, and so I would comment on this. For example, down in Livingston County, which is part of our district, the people who are politically engaged in Livingston County have done a great job. They had a dinner for all of us. They put three forums up. But here in Ingham County, where all four of us are from, we haven't had any of that. And so it's this cultural change, and we've been all talking to voters. But, you know, for example, Mark, I'll be on the street and I'll talk to a Republican voter. And actually, when we've had a chance to talk, I'll get a Republican to say, I haven't thought about voting for a Democrat for 20 years, but since I've actually had a chance to engage with you and speak with you and hear your ideas, maybe I'll consider it. Mm-hmm. But if we can't reach those voters, which we're having difficulty doing, they're never going to get that message, and that's the problem.
Just about out of time, unfortunately. You've got a forum coming up on the 22nd, IBEW Hall, South Pennsylvania.
That's right.
What is the time?
7 to 9 p.m.
7 to 9 p.m. on the 22nd. All four Democratic candidates for the 8th District Congressional nod.
And we will have a forum later that's on home TV, I believe. It's the 29th. There will be something very, very close to
Meridian
the election.
Township Community Television. Jeff Hanks, Susan Grettenberger, thanks for joining
thank
us.
Thank you so much.
Good
and
luck,
Mark.
Thank you.
It is Wednesday, and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, we feature the International Friendship Program at Michigan State University. The IFP is an organization that aims to ease the transition for international students and connect Lansing residents with the world by sponsoring cross-cultural friendships. Here to tell us more about the program is Pam Sievers, a committee member with the International Friendship Program. Joining Pam is Cindy Walter, a longtime participant and academic advisor in MSU's Department of Linguistics and Languages. Also with us, Fabors Donishvar, Cindy's current friend from the International Friendship Program. Welcome, one and all.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Pam, give us a brief overview of the IFP program here at MSU. How long has it been around?
The IFP program, first of all, is part of Community Volunteers for International Programs, which is the broader umbrella organization that serves to build bridges and links the international students with the community and vice versa. I imagine that the IFP program, truthfully, has probably been around a good 40 years or so. And to be honest, I don't know exactly how it started, but it would be logical to assume that it would have been the result of professors and their families reaching out, extending a hand to newly arrived international students here on MSU's campus.
Farah Bors, when did you arrive here from Iran?
I was here and this is my third year living in East Lansing. And after first year, I met Cindy from CVIP program, and I had a chance to get involved with American family more close and.
But you said 10 years ago?
3 years ago.
3 years ago, sorry. I beg your pardon. Okay.
And now it's about 2 years that I know Cindy and their family. And to me, that was a very good experience of having a sense of being with the family. I have many friends over here, but those are not going to give me the sense of having family. Cindy and Todd were like my, and they acting like as their child. And
surrogate family.
Yeah.
Almost. How challenging was that when you first got here? Did you feel pretty isolated?
No. We had a very good community over here. Iranian students have a Persian student association over here.
Okay.
So they help a student, new coming student to get in, to be settled down easily for the first days. But those connections are totally different with having the family.
Cindy, what sorts of things do you guys do together?
Well, we have two children. They're both teenagers. And what we hope to do is help Faribours get a glimpse of life outside of campus in American community and in a typical American home. And so we invite him often to just things we're already doing. He had Thanksgiving with us when we first met. He goes to sporting events that my son's participating in. He has come to theater productions with my daughter. He helped us over the prepare for holidays just to get kind of the traditions that a lot of American families participate in.
How often do you get together?
We shoot for once a month. He's pretty busy with his research as a PhD student. So sometimes it goes a little longer, but we're Facebook friends, so I know he travels a lot, too, when he has weekends and breaks. So.
As it should be, I think.
So I always know what's going on, even if we don't see each other as often as we would like.
Pam, how does the program work? How do you identify who gets paired with whom?
You know, we have an application process that can be found on our website, and I'll share that information in a minute. But we ask both applicants and students similar types of questions, so we can match as often as we can based on common interests. Occasionally there might be some preferences, but we really try to get a good feel. All of the students are personally interviewed by committee members. All of our volunteers are personally interviewed by committee members, so that we really try to sit down then and look and see, this individual enjoys more of the cultural things. And so this student enjoys theater
sporting
and
events,
dance or sporting events. So we really try to match based on what we feel are common interests, as well, frankly, as some logistical challenges, too.
How many participants do you have right now?
Right now, it would be fair to say that we probably still have around 200 participants, because we do expect each year we match around 80 students. And the expectation is that both the friend and the student commit to it for a year. But we know that the majority of the students who are remaining on campus after the year remain in those friendships for a period of time. But we do match about 80, but it would be fair to assume that we would have, based on our feedback, probably at least 200 still in some kind of ongoing relationships.
It's Neighbors in Action here on WKAR's Current State. We are learning about the International Friendship Program here at Michigan State for Neighbors in Action. Faribours, how did the reality of living in the United States differ from your expectations before you arrived? Mm-hmm. Was it profoundly different? Was it about what you expected? What?
What I know about the living in the U.S. was most related to Hollywood movies.
We've heard that so many times.
But actual life, the experience, especially with Cindy and her family, was very close to the same style of living we have in our country.
Okay. So. And what have you learned from being a part of the International Friendship Program?
Most of the things that I learned was about the U.S. cultures. For example, I didn't know anything about Thanksgiving or Independence Day. So we get together for those holidays and we spend more time, and they let me know more about those cultures.
Mm-hmm. Cindy, how does that make you feel, hearing Faribours say that life here actually resembles life back home?
I think that's really great.
In the family.
Right. Yeah. Faribours is very close to his family. We actually had the good fortune of meeting his parents.
Oh,
I've never
great.
Been able to do that before with our students we've hosted. They were here for about 5 months visiting. Mm-hmm. And that was just a great way to get a glimpse into the relationships and how much, just being human, we're similar, and how families often We tend to focus on the differences, but it's wonderful to see the commonalities we have.
How many different international friends have you made through this program?
I've hosted probably about 11 years. So usually I'm hosting students that are only here for a semester or a year. But in the case of Faribault, he's here for a longer amount of time. So probably a good 12 to 15 students over time.
What are you studying, Faribault?
Biosystem engineering.
I'm sorry?
Biosystem engineering.
Okay, biosystems engineering. Pam, where does your funding come for International Friendship Program?
Well, fortunately, we keep our funding very low, but we do get some nice support from the Office for International Students and Scholars here on campus. But we don't have a lot of costs related to this. We are an all-volunteer, staffed-led organization. So the only funding that we ever look for is assistance to buy some minor refreshments when we have our orientation meetings in the course of the year. And that's really about our only funding. We do get certainly some computer support through MSU's Office of International Students and Scholars.
And if people are interested in getting involved, Pam, how do they go about it?
Well, our best suggestion is to call the office, the CVIP office, which is a volunteer-staffed office. If you get a recording, please just leave your name and someone will get back to you. But the number is 353-1735, 353-1735. Our website is cvip.msu.edu. And when you look at that page, the CVIP page, you will see the links to the various programs in the upper left, and you'll find a link there for the International Friendship Program.
Sounds like a really enriching experience for everybody involved, and we commend all of you for being involved in it. Pam Sievers is a committee member with the International Friendship Program. Cindy Walter is a longtime participant in IFP, and Faribault Dhanashvar is Cindy's current friend from the International Friendship Program. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work, but we just don't know about them. Please help us out and tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll take a look into the financial situation in Flint. It requires an update. Also, we'll hear from the other side of the aisle as we talk with Sam Sings, Republican opponents for the 69th District race. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.